Welcome to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Catherine Ident in for Steve Junker. This is our weekly News Roundup, where we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with some of my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in studio this morning is WCAI reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Joining us in a few minutes will be Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times. And this hour, we'll also hear from George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner, and we'll check in with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle and WCAI reporter Eve Zukoff. But Sarah, I want to start with you first. We have a lot to talk about. You had a really busy week following some big stories around the region. I want to talk first about Vineyard Wind. There was a lot of developments with that project this week, and you know, some conjectures that with some news from the federal government that the project would be delayed and maybe would fail. So what's the latest right now?
All right. So I guess just to bring people up to speed, if they have not been following closely, late last week, Vineyard Wind announced that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which is a federal bureau, had delayed the release of their final environmental review of the project. It turns out the bureau says they were surprised by how quickly the offshore wind industry was catching on in this region. And they said they wanted to do further supplemental environmental reviews of the lease areas for all the proposed offshore wind farms, not just Vineyard Wind's. They also cited that they still had not fully determined the impact of wind farms in this area off Martha's Vineyard, and they had not determined the impact that this would have on fisheries. So there's things like the Rhode Island squid fishery that's really said that these turbines might create a situation that would be very difficult for them to navigate their boats around. Mm-hmm. So they said there were undetermined impacts of that that they still had to figure out via some supplemental reviews. And so there's thought that this could take potentially months more, which could potentially push that Vineyard Wind timeline back a year or more, given their construction timeline and how they're trying to avoid right whale breeding season and all this stuff. Mm-hmm.
And of course, when we learned this news, there was a lot of talk about federal tax credits that seemed pretty important to Vineyard Wind. And so therefore, that's the conjecture I mentioned that the project might not be able to succeed. Talk about that.
Yeah, the tax credits are definitely a huge factor, though I spoke with an expert who follows this industry pretty closely from Wood Mackenzie, and they said that the tax credits are actually probably not going to be the breaker of the project, interestingly enough. Likely, Vineyard Wind will still be eligible for them. As he said, the IRS has been known to be somewhat lenient with deadlines like this, given that this project has been delayed by outside forces that were out of their control. However, the bigger worry is investors and how this delay might affect them, especially with the industry being thrown into such uncertainty by this kind of broad statement delay from the federal government with no real timeline proposed. The expert didn't believe that this would totally kill the project, but he warned that it might mean that ratepayers may not get as competitive a rate as was initially promised by the company.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we should mention, too, for those who may be wondering what Vineyard Wind is, it's a proposed 84-turbine wind farm. It's in federal waters south of Martha's Vineyard. So there were some unhappy people out there. and we heard from Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is blaming the Trump administration, saying that they're kind of purposely slowing this down because perhaps the Trump administration, according to Warren, has other priorities, primarily oil and gas. But you also went and heard from local groups, including groups with an environmental focus, who want Vineyard Wind to succeed.
Yeah. So I went to, I guess there was a press conference held yesterday. A number of different officials and groups on Cape Cod showed up to basically express their unhappiness about this decision. At the press conference yesterday, there was the Association to Preserve Cape Cod speaking out right next to the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, as well as a Marine Pile Drivers Union. So a number of kind of interesting groups that seem somewhat unrelated on the surface have all kind of convalesced. It's clear that the Vineyard Wind project could promise a whole lot of positive things for this region, from renewable energy creation to job creation to a little boost to our economy here. So there's a lot that the Cape has invested in its success.
Mm-hmm. And Vineyard Wind, there's been, you know, we've talked about this before. You've reported on fishermen, especially in Rhode Island, who really have some concerns about this project. And Vineyard Wind had said they'd come out with some different layout plans. Are they going to be changing the plan again as they wait for the federal government? Or do you have any idea about that?
It doesn't seem so. I think that ends up being a very, and I suppose I am not like 100% the expert on this, but from what I can gather, it seems that it is a pretty difficult process. There's a whole lot of engineering that goes into deciding what orientation every turbine is going to have and the spacing of each one. And so if they have to go back to the drawing board and redo all of that, I mean, that's going to be a huge delay. So I don't believe that they have plans to do that at
okay.
this point.
So we're waiting for the federal government at this point. Okay.
Yeah.
I want to turn to another big story that had you racing around this week, and that is the threat. It's a serious story from Triple E, and that's Eastern Equine Encephalitis. It's carried by mosquitoes, and if a mosquito infected with that virus bites a human, it can cause some serious health problems. There's a man in Rochester reported to have contracted the virus and who is very ill. And we have communities along the South Coast and Plymouth counties, county with elevated risk. And then, of course, it's now shown up in two places on the Cape, here in Falmouth this week, and also, we've just learned today, in Bourne as well. So you went out and you wanted to see how the Cape Cod Mosquito Control Project collects the mosquitoes. Talk about what you saw and what you learned.
Sure. So I guess, definitely first up front, Triple E is definitely a real and present thing. Mm-hmm. It is definitely out there. There were mosquitoes that tested positive for it in Falmouth earlier this month. And so the town basically hired a number of trucks from central Massachusetts to come down and spray one evening in neighborhoods near the two sites that had positive mosquitoes carrying the virus. And they've sent up more mosquitoes up for testing this week to just see if that spraying has been effective. And of course, that spraying is to knock down those flying mosquitoes as opposed to just planting larvicide or something like that in the swamps, which they've already been doing all summer. Mm-hmm. Collecting samples is a little bit scary. The man who does it definitely does not want to be in the woods for very long. So we were pretty much in and out. We ran in, we grabbed the trap, we ran out. But the trap is actually pretty cool looking. It's got three components. It's got a bucket of dry ice that emits carbon dioxide to mimic a human breathing. And then under that bucket, there's a light, and then there's a vacuum, and then there's a net. And so I guess the idea is that you'll kind of attract the mosquitoes and then very gently vacuum them into a net without harming them, since they need to be live and unharmed in order to be properly tested.
Oh, wow. So a little bit of a risk going in there, I imagine. Did you have to spray like copious amounts of bug repellent before you went?
Yeah. The man definitely got me pretty good with the DEET. But I was surprised that they don't wear any sort of like suits or anything like that to protect, that you just spray a whole lot. He said it's very, very effective, is in his words. And then we just run in and grab it. It's a little bit scary to carry a net full of live mosquitoes.
I imagine. Yeah, it takes a special kind of person, and it's an important job. They'll be continuing that this summer. You also went out and talked to some of the folks that did the spraying here in Falmouth. That was a quick decision, I gather, by Falmouth officials once they located those five pools with those mosquitoes in them. It isn't very common down here on the Cape to see mosquitoes with Triple E, and we haven't had spraying. They've been doing aerial spraying on the South Coast, several sprays, I think, several rounds of that. But here, the truck spraying was a little unusual.
Yeah, trucks are something that we haven't had to bring in before, just because, you know, crews plant the larvicide in the swamps, and usually that's enough to control the population. But apparently this year's mosquito population across the state, not just here, is just much higher than in the past. And that's why we've gotten Triple E in the first place. We had a pretty, we had a pretty extended warm fall in last year, which is when mosquitoes are laying their eggs. And then this spring, when they're hatching, it was very, very rainy. And so there were ideal conditions for a lot of mosquitoes.
Ah, I see. And so that's why we're seeing this crop up in such kind of, abundance, I would say, really.
Yeah, essentially, I guess the state epidemiologist says, you know, mosquitoes here usually don't carry it, but one infected bird from the South Coast probably flew over here. And then given the high numbers of mosquitoes that we already had, it just made for the perfect storm of mosquito transmission of Triple E.
And with the spraying itself, was there any concern? Was anybody concerned? I know some organizations and property owners opted out of the spraying this week. Talk about that.
Yeah. So a number of comments from people who are worried. But I guess first, the good news is that I spoke with the Barnstable Beekeepers Association, and they mentioned that they actually were not very concerned, and they were advising their constituents to also not be worried. They said that this spraying happened at night, which is when most bees are back in their hives, and that most people who keep bees keep their hives off the road behind their houses anyways. And this was just road spraying. And so there wasn't really too much of a fear that this pesticide would leak over too much. And they also said that they told their members to simply, if you're really worried, put a sheet over your hive, and to also just make sure things like bird baths or any standing water were emptied out beforehand, since, you know, the pesticide can get into that water. And then if the bees use that water, that could be dangerous. So just some things to kind of be cautious of. But overall, they said there wasn't too much worry. You know, the bigger threat is actually from neighbors who regularly have private companies who spray during the day. That could be a much bigger threat. And that's right. Something you can't really control.
Right. And that's when the pollinators are active. And so that's why that's a bigger risk.
Yeah, exactly. And I, you know, other people, not just beekeepers, but a number of other people were concerned. They felt that not a lot of information was given out about Zenovex before the town decided that they would use it. Just kind of some lack of information transfer. I think a lot of people were surprised that it was happening. Mm-hmm. A lot of people did go online to opt out from the website. But then they said that they saw a note that said you had to submit an opt-out form 2 weeks ahead of time. And that was something that wasn't possible in this case, given that everyone had about like maybe a week's heads up or something like that. So, you know, just people may be a little upset at how quickly that decision was made. Although you also have to understand that the town of Falmouth, if you are told that you've got mosquitoes carrying this deadly virus, you probably want to move quickly.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like they had to kind of act, just make that decision and go forward. So I want to look now at news about Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, a story that we follow very closely. It looks highly likely that the NRC will formally or make that final approval of the sale of the plant to Holtec International. Although the staff of the NRC kind of had a caveat this week when that news was made public.
Yeah, so there has been a big to-do about the Holtec Pilgrim transfer. The Citizens Advisory Board has been, sending out notices and messages just about how concerned they are if Holtec does take over this plant, given that Holtec has essentially refused to negotiate any terms with the town of Plymouth in terms of, you know, how they plan to rehabilitate that land that the plant sits on, how they plan to ensure that they're going to be able to fully pay for the decommissioning, how they're going to make sure that the decommissioning casks are actually safe from radioactive material leaking out. So many questions that Holtec has not answered. And so there were some thoughts that, you know, the Attorney General's office put forward a request to have a hearing to delay this transfer a little bit, pending some answers to some questions. And so the NRC kind of turned around and they said, we are approving this project tentatively. However, we're going to give our commission members 5 business days to consider whether they're going to take the hearings into account before they make their final decision. Mm-hmm. So that decision could be coming as early as, or as late as, I guess, early this coming week. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to see.
And you spoke with NRC spokesperson Neil Sheehan, I believe, who said that they feel, obviously, they feel confident that Holtec can manage this on this accelerated timeline, which is very short as compared to the many decades that Entergy Corporation wanted to take to decommission Pilgrim.
Yeah, Entergy said that it would take them like 60 plus years to decommission the site, and Holtec came in and said that they could do it in about 8. And so, you know, there's obviously concern about how in the world they're going to do that. And Holtec hasn't really given any answers. Neil Sheehan did say that in terms of like they felt that the plant was, it had enough in its decommissioning fund. We've got about $1 billion in there. People have been concerned that that's not enough money to decommission the plant. However, Neil said that there have been plants. I mean, obviously, it's hard to compare apples to oranges with different plants, but certainly the Vermont Yankee plant, different circumstances, but did decommission with a lot less money in their fund. And so he felt that Holtec was totally financially able to decommission Pilgrim with the amount of money there. They felt that they were technically and financially stable enough to do this job right.
And we will be keeping a close eye on this and following up on other threads that come out in this story. That is WCAI reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Catherine.
Have a great weekend. Welcome back to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Catherine Ident, talking with local journalists from around the region about the top stories of the week. And with me now in studio is Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Catherine.
Gwen, I want to start with a story out this week about a research group that we heard a lot about a couple years ago, as they did quite a bit of research around sharks in our region, but then kind of left the area. But now they're back. It's called O-Search, and they have a boat in federal waters off Nantucket trying to get shark samples.
They do, and I have to point out that while most of us are watching out to avoid sharks, these guys are looking for sharks.
Yes.
The team is hoping to tag at least 17 great white sharks over the next couple of weeks. They're going to be here until August 26th, and then they're going to go up to Nova Scotia to do the same kind of work there. And as you mentioned, they have a boat, which is a 126-foot former Alaskan crab boat. And the thing that makes this particularly suited to the work they're doing is it has a movable platform. And once they hook the shark, they can get the platform under it and lift the shark out of the water so that they can take their blood, do their tagging, you know, do everything they need to do, even ultrasound. Mm-hmm. They do even ultrasound. And that's made possible because they have this platform, you know. And without hurting the shark, and then they release it. And there are several studies going on. This is one of the people who is working on this is from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. His name is Simon Thorold. He's involved in three of the studies, but the data that they collected last time has provided an impetus for several studies. And let me just look at my notes here, and I can tell you a little bit about the studies that Mr. Thorold is working on.
Well, I think it's important to note that we don't know very much about sharks because they are kind of deep ocean animals traditionally, and being able to have a boat kind of capture them and take them on and as uninvasively as possible get some real samples from them is, I'm sure, really helping kind of move this research forward for people like Simon and other researchers.
It is. And, you know, it's interesting because the research is not just telling us about sharks, but it's telling us about the world they live in and about how one of the fascinating studies that's written about, that Doug Fraser writes about, is that they're studying the bacteria in the shark's mouths, because if someone is bitten, you know, a human, they want to know how to treat that person better from the start. So, you know, that's sort of an interesting way of looking at it. You're looking at the shark to see how you can help the human, you know, heaven forbid, let's hope we don't have any of that. But and then, you know, another look at this is that one of the newer studies is looking at the prevalence of microplastics. And those are the tiny, tiny bits of plastic that tend to aggregate in predators in the, you know, top of the food chain. So, you know, it's telling us about the life of the great white shark, migration patterns, things like that. But it's also telling us things that we need to know about our world and living with those sharks.
Mm-hmm. And also telling us about, yeah, as you said, related to sharks, but also microplastics are everywhere and they're in all of us. And so that's helpful in building that body of data for other studies that may not even end up being related to sharks in the future.
Right. And you could say that they are a bit of a barometer for, you know, the numbers that we're seeing in the water. We can see how they're affecting sea life, you know, aggregating in those bigger sea animals.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn now to a land-based story, and that's mainly based in Hyannis, and it's about the gas and convenience store chain Cumberland Farms. And they were issued a cease and desist order this week by the town of Barnstable for essentially setting up a store within a store, so kind of flouting some new regulations.
Okay, we're talking about the two bigger Cumberland Farms. The small one by the airport rotary is not involved because they didn't do that. They didn't set up a store within a store. The town basically said in that letter, that it's from the town's chief health inspector, that if you do not stop selling these flavored tobacco products, we will, you know, you will be looking at losing all of your licenses to sell, not just tobacco, but all of your licenses here in town. And this goes back to the fact that 3 weeks ago, Barnstable instituted a regulation that says that flavored tobacco products can only be sold in facilities in businesses that are only open to people who are 21 and over. The idea being that those products have a lot of appeal for younger smokers and whether it's vaping or tobacco smoke. So mm-hmm. they wanted to get them, you know, less access to them.
Right.
So, you know, Cumberland Farms responded by setting up portable walls and selling them only within those walls, but the town said, that's not enough. You can't do it that way.
Right. And Cumberland Farms is suing the town of Barnstable as well as a couple other towns off Cape, saying that these regulations, which are fairly new, are unfair and that it's making it so that what they're calling competing businesses have an unfair advantage. So we will be talking about this, I think, as this case goes forward.
Yes. And while that suit goes on, we should say that the Cumberland Farms, although they didn't talk to us for this story, they did say through representatives that they will stop selling the products in the stores.
I want to take a look at an announcement that is in today's paper, and that's from Cape Cod Hospital with plans for a huge, expansive, we'll be able to see it on the horizon if this ends up getting built.
Yes, if you take a look at the paper, the CapeCodTimes.com, you can see, because we have a rendering of the proposed new building next to the others, and it's definitely the big brother or big sister of
six
them.
Stories, right?
Six stories, $180 million, and the basic reason for this is to keep people on the Cape for high-level care, particularly in cancer and trauma. Mm-hmm. And there are an estimated 8,000 people now who go off Cape for their treatment. And this the idea is that this would make them be much more convenient. And when we had an editorial board meeting, the Cape Cod Healthcare president and CEO Michael Loff said that what they're hoping to do is form partnerships with the Boston hospitals, not to, not to be owned by them, not mm-hmm. to be taken over by them. They still, Cape Cod Healthcare wants to remain independent. So in terms of numbers and how big it would be, 120,000 to 140,000 square feet between the existing Mugar building and the Gleason House on Lewis Bay Road. So it kind of overlooks the water there.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about some of the new things, 30 chemotherapy bays and about 50 new beds, 49. And they also are talking jobs. This would probably generate 80 to 90 new jobs.
Mm. And this is just in the planning stage. This still needs to be approved by the Cape Cod Commission, among other things. But certainly interesting to kind of see the artist's rendering and look at, as you were reading, some of the stats, which are all available on the Cape Cod Times website.
It's a little breakout, too, so you can get that by-the-numbers look. And,
yeah, it's great.
They are hoping to break ground next month.
And that is Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, thank you as always.
Nice to see you, Catherine.
I want to turn now and take a look at news on Martha's Vineyard. I have on the phone George Brennan, who's news editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Katie. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us. So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers found what they think are human remains, and this is why while they were finishing up a multi-year project to clear up munitions in Cape Pogue Bay.
That's right. As you said, 3 years of researching, digging, and sifting, and at one point they found a plane, and when they pulled the plane up, they found human remains, which, you know, is very intriguing, of course. Those remains have been turned over to the chief medical examiner's office in Boston. We don't have any word yet on what they've determined, but if they do determine that it was someone from the military, those will be turned over to Dover Air Force Base, which conducts examinations of armed forces. Now, overall, this project, like I said, was 3 years in the making, and they pulled up all kinds of munitions. This is an area that was used at one point as a test bombing site by the military during World War II. So 2,061 munitions, a whole lot more debris was found, and some of it was intact. Like, they found a machine gun intact, so pretty interesting investigation all around. And we could we could be able to solve a mystery at some point as well.
Absolutely. And it will be interesting to see what the Boston Medical Chief Medical Examiner can come up with. I mean, that's when technology that we have today is so amazing. And as you said, could help a family find someone that was lost. So
absolutely.
Officials in several towns on the island are considering applications for both recreational and medical marijuana dispensaries.
That's right. So there was an existing application already for Vineyard Haven, and now there's a secondary one. The group went before the Tisbury Board of Selectmen on Tuesday night. This was all preliminary. They were talking about one on Mechanics Street in Vineyard Haven, and it's a partnership between someone who's a seasonal resident of the vineyard and a group that already has two licenses in Massachusetts, one in Orange and the other in Williamstown. Now, interestingly, I did this story, and yesterday I did a little bit more research. Noah Eisendrath, he owns two bars in Boston, and it turns out those bars have recently been had their licenses suspended for 10 days as a result of serving to minors. One of the big issues on the island with these licenses is how do we keep it away from children? So he's going to have some questions to answer about these incidents at his bars. Now, it is a different process for retail marijuana outlets, as his partner explains. You have to go into a vestibule. You have to show an ID before you go in. You have to show an ID while you're in there. So they're saying there are safety measures in place, so something that happened at his bar couldn't happen at this marijuana facility.
Hmm. Well, we'll be following up on that, I'm sure, as marijuana kind of expands off the vineyard, Nantucket, and across the Cape as well. George, we only have about 30 seconds, but it is a big weekend around the region with, you know, some big events on the island. We've got the Falmouth Road Race, and that's causing some changes at the Steamship Authority. What's the highlight of that? What should people know?
Well, tonight is the OB fireworks, and anybody who would take a ferry out of OB normally will want to go to Vineyard Haven instead. And then on Sunday morning, you're probably better off not going on the early morning ferries, because Woods Hole is just going to be a crowd of people, and the buses won't be rolling, and you won't be able to get your car out of Woods Hole that morning. So you're better off either traveling Saturday or Monday.
Mm. George, thank you for that. All those updates. That's George Brennan, news editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Have a great weekend. Talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Katie. You too.
I have Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle on the phone now. Good morning, Tim. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Katie.
Tim, there was a surprise closure of Stage Harbor Road because of a sinkhole. What happened?
Well, this is a pretty unusual story. Earlier in the month, a property owner who lives across Stage Harbor Road from Oyster Pond noticed that there had been some flooding in a bog near him, and he called town officials. And town officials began to explore the situation, and they discovered basically a potential sinkhole beneath the road. The road was shut down, and repairs were made over a three-day period. Unfortunately, during the days that they made the repairs earlier this week, if you remember, the weather was kind of rainy and cloudy.
Yeah.
So it contributed to an even more chaotic and crowded situation in downtown Chatham. They had to block off the road, and traffic was basically detoured right into the Main Street downtown area, which is already packed at the best of times.
Right.
So it was a bit of a congested time. But the problem, it turned out that there was supposed to be a pipe beneath the road that drained that bog. But
mm-hmm.
when officials investigated, they looked at plans. There was a pipe shown on the plans. When they dug it up, they found that there was actually no pipe there. And what was happening apparently was that as the tide was coming in and out of Oyster Pond, it was pushing groundwater back and forth, and without a pipe to channel it, that water was eroding the area underneath the roadway. And so it's a good thing that bog flooded. Otherwise, eventually, most likely, that sinkhole might have collapsed the roadway, which would have been an even more catastrophic situation.
Yeah.
You know, we wouldn't just have been dealing with traffic situations. There could have been more more grievous situation there. Officials aren't sure why the pipe wasn't there. They don't know if it had been maybe displaced by the tidal flows. They even brought in a retired highway surveyor to try to find it. He thought there was a pipe there too. But they eventually, as I said earlier this week, they dug up the road, they put a new pipe in, they fixed the situation, and by Thursday morning, traffic down there was back to normal.
Wow, that really is kind of the case, like you said, of a little bit of odd luck that a little flooding happened and was just a little bit of a flag that there was
exactly.
a bigger issue.
Exactly. And it kind of shows, you know, if you see something that's a little unusual, you know, you might want to just report it.
Right. Yeah. Take a second look. Don't just walk by.
Exactly. Exactly.
Tim Wood, thanks for checking in of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Katie. You too.
I want to go to the Outer Cape now and talk with Casey Myers of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us. You have a story out this week about rental scams, specifically scammers who are operating on Craigslist. Tell us how this scam works.
Sure. This is a problem that police have been dealing with on the Outer Cape and perhaps all of Cape Cod for the past few years. Provincetown and Wellfleet Police each reported 3 complaints in their towns in 2019. And what happens is a scammer will take real photographs and information on a property from a real estate website and paste it into a rental advertisement on Craigslist, usually. The suspect will then ask perhaps an eye-catchingly low price and request deposits or payment. And then when the renter shows up thinking they've got this great deal, they discover the real homeowner is often at home and that they've lost their money and that they have no vacation home. And this has happened in the case of one Provincetown homeowner. He says his house has been featured at least 12 times in 2 years in fake Craigslist ads.
Oh, that's it's got to be maddening.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is Jonathan Scott and his husband. They describe gleeful vacationers showing up at their door expecting to, you know, have this great house for the week. And they've, you know, had to interrupt dinner and they will drive people. They've driven people repeatedly to the police stations. And then when they go out, they even put a sign on their door saying, if you're thinking you're going to be renting our house, it's a mistake. You've been scammed. I mean, you know, it's kind of really changed their lives.
Yeah.
And luckily, they say it hasn't happened now in 10 months, but it's been, I mean, they still scan Craigslist all the time.
They have to be vigilant, I imagine. And any help from Craigslist on kind of rooting these out and getting them taken down?
Well, you know, according to Jonathan Scott, the homeowner, no, absolutely not. He said it's been maddening. He's tried really hard. He even contacted the FBI to try to get help, and he simply can't get through to Craigslist. He says they have absolutely no accountability at all. And our reporter tried as well to get a hold of Craigslist and also was unable to completely.
Mm-hmm.
The police do have some tips, though, for renters. I'm really not sure how homeowners avoid it because, you know, even homes that aren't listed now are up on real estate websites with photos and stuff. But for renters, of course, don't use Craigslist. It's definitely the most notorious. But even Airbnb's verification process has a lot of holes and is pretty easy to hack. And then become knowledgeable about the going rate of rental properties in the area and be suspicious if something is less expensive.
Right.
Police say check the owner's name of the property in the assessor's database in the town where you're renting because that's online and it's very legitimate, and if they don't match up with the person trying to rent you the place, that's a big red flag. And do not pay by check. Don't use a gift card. Don't wire money. These are all easy ways that people scammers will try to just take your money and without any kind of recourse at all, especially a gift card. Chief Golden said if they ask for a gift card, that's
a sign.
Total.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Police have a very hard time tracking down these people because it's so easy for them to create fake identities online.
Right. And not even be in the country, perhaps. Right.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So if it's too good to be true, then it's probably too good to be true.
Exactly.
Casey Myers of the Provincetown Banner, thanks so much for checking in and bringing us this story. Have a great weekend.
Okay, you too. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Welcome back to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Catherine Ident. Beacon Hill is on vacation, but that doesn't mean there aren't important issues being worked out in the state's capital. I talked with WCAI Statehouse reporter Mike Dean for a weekly update. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning.
So as we've discussed, Mike, lawmakers are on recess for the month, but some education advocates threw them a little party before the halls of Beacon Hill quieted down.
Yeah, a number of kind of education activists staged a beach party for lawmakers outside the gates of the State House at the end of last month before they broke for August. That's because the House is expected to finally get the issue of K-12 education funding underway. People expect a plan to come out of the House Education Committee, or at least the House side of the Education Committee, that will kind of be the vehicle going forward for this big debate about, you know, the funding formula for cities and towns and school districts that we talk about all the time. This beach party was basically a little bit of a, you know, shaming opportunity for those advocates to see the lawmakers off before they you know, took that recess month.
Remind us of the timeline. Lawmakers are on recess until Labor Day.
Yeah, it's an interesting timeline. This fall phase is something that a lot of the deadlines that move around here, when they say, well, this will be done this year or this will be done, you know, the first half of the session. So we only have between Labor Day and it's actually November 20th when they break for the holidays. So right around Thanksgiving, that's when things kind of shut down again. So it's only 11 weeks to do an awful lot of the stuff they want to get done in this first year of their 2-year session. And there's so many big issues that they've been talking about taking action on and, you know, bringing to the floor for votes, not just that education funding formula bit, but, you know, things like transportation, you know, funding for the MBTA, how to fund those things, which probably means raising taxes if we're going to be spending more on education, spending more on transportation infrastructure. These are things that have been talked about since January, if not longer. And it's now the time has come for them to really put some detailed plans together.
And not all lawmakers went right to their districts when they went on recess earlier this month. Many of them traveled to Nashville last week for a gathering of state lawmakers. What's the importance of that?
Yeah, it's a national gathering of members of legislatures. So it's, you know, a state senator from Massachusetts is going to be on a panel with a state senator from Tennessee or things like that. It's kind of, you know, it's a trade organization kind of a thing. You know, every industry kind of has things like this, and state lawmakers are not any different. And, you know, it is an opportunity to trade ideas, to see how other, you know, legislatures around the country deal with the federal dynamics as we see them. I think one thing that Massachusetts brings to the table is that we do have a fairly bipartisan operation going on here with a Republican governor, even though the legislature is completely dominated by Democrats. And then that's the kind of thing that I know that Speaker Robert DeLeo tries to put forward when he goes to events like this one in Nashville. For instance, the speaker was telling me a week or two ago about how his efforts to kind of expand Massachusetts gun laws, the example set by gun laws that we have here, into other states in the absence of, you know, federal legislation, things like that. So it is, you know, there's certainly some social gatherings as well at things like this. But I think for the most part, it is a legitimate use of lawmakers' time during this break.
I want to turn to other news. Governor Charlie Baker issued his long-awaited report on traffic congestion last week. And we know that Boston roads are a mess. Did the Cape get a mention?
It did, yeah. And surprise, surprise, it's the bridges for the most part. That's
right.
Where the Cape was mentioned most in this congestion report. It's 127 or so, 150 so pages of duh. You know, I think as some people were putting it. But the thing is, it's an extremely detailed report on, you know, what time of day, where those pressure points are. Everybody knows traffic's terrible, but this report is really detailed enough to let government officials tackle the specifics of how to get things going. And I think the major news out of this was Charlie Baker, the governor, kind of wants what's called a managed lane, which could be potentially adding another lane to those really those choke point highways, most notably 95 and 93, which is probably of some interest to your listeners there on the Cape, that would actually kind of be like a new pay-for lane, that kind of a thing. But there was lots of other talk about different kinds of projects. New bridges were mentioned throughout that report. That's obviously a very complicated plan, but it is something that the state acknowledges is going to have to happen within the next, you know, amount of time, mm-hmm. however long you have. Obviously, the Army has to do with the bridge project and everything. It's a little more complicated than a regular highway, but it is something that the state now has far more data on the specifics of than they did before.
Right. And I also read about already some controversy over that managed lane idea. So I'm sure there'll be a lot more to talk about before we see any action there. And another transportation-related story, and that's the developing story with the Registry of Motor Vehicles. The RMV came out this week with another batch of suspended licenses, I think more than 850. And that's because it came to light that the RMV failed for years to suspend driver's licenses of Massachusetts residents who had offenses in other states. Are lawmakers keeping the pressure on the RMV when it comes to finding who's to blame and what can be done about it?
Yeah, actually, the two co-chairmen of the Transportation Committee have actually been more aggressive on this oversight issue than really the legislature has been on almost anything in a pretty long time. Those two chairmen, they were demanding access to additional correspondence and data from the RMV that they did not get from the Baker administration for their first hearing. They keep asking for these things. And then they circulated a letter pretty much demanding a number of bits of correspondence and data about vendor relationships and, you know, who did what when. Staffing levels within the RMV headquarters, things like that. And the Baker administration, even though they are probably wrapping up their internal investigation, they wouldn't commit to giving them the access to that data they wanted. However, they have been kind of ponying up a lot of that stuff this week. So I think that the legislature is happy with the cooperation level at this point. They had to pull teeth a little bit, but they got the teeth, you know, out of MassDOT. And that is something that I think that lawmakers, as this internal investigation winds down and lawmakers have a clearer picture of exactly what was going on, we could see them take action, not necessarily punitive action against individuals or the RMV itself, but reforms to keep this kind of thing from happening again, which I would have to imagine that the Baker administration would also be in support of.
So maybe no criminal charges against anyone at the RMV at the end of all this?
That's really still to be determined. It looks like the kind of negligence we're talking about was systemic. Whether or not that leads to criminal charges, I think that these investigations will really need to wind down. There are no charges right now, certainly, but you know the Attorney General's office is obviously aware of this. We'll see, you know, what both the Baker administration's internal investigation, their third party audit, and the legislature's own investigation kind of determine whether or not there is, you know, a crime that has been committed. That is uncertain right now.
And finally, just briefly, water quality was in the news this week, and you reported on it. So not at the outset necessarily Beacon Hill related, but I do have a law related question. Briefly kind of give us a roundup of what that report said.
Yeah, the big picture here was that the water around beaches can be more polluted and more dangerous than you may anticipate or may think. This was measuring whether or not beach water was potentially harmful at least one day out of the year. And Massachusetts was cleaner than the national average. It tested, it was a national survey of water samples. This was kind of from environmental advocates were pushing this report as a way to make their big issue about sewer leaks and runoff. This is something where they said that the pollution, at least in Massachusetts, is mostly caused by overflowing, you know, flood apparatus. In an urban area like Boston, you're going to get beaches very close to your sewer system. If there's a storm that floods that system, a lot of that runoff is going to go into the beach water. But the rest of the state is really subject to what gets into the rivers and the waterways throughout the state. This is an attempt to try to get lawmakers to push more infrastructure, better, greener technologies to keep these waterways clean.
Will this have any impact on the legislative process?
It's something that, you know, has all been around for a number of years. I think this report probably got the attention of a lot of lawmakers. Maybe when they're at the beach themselves and they hear about this story on the radio, it might get some of their attention. It's an issue that may come around when we talk about climate change mitigation, building new types of flood-resisting infrastructure, things like that. And I think the advocates here want that whenever we build new infrastructure or replace old stuff, to make it as green as possible and to cut down on that bacteria flow that has been happening with our century-old system that we have now.
And I should note, just three beaches or areas on the Cape were considered problematic, and that was two around Provincetown Harbor and one in East Ham. Mike Dean, our State House reporter, thanks so much for this check-in, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Great to be with you.
You're listening to the News Roundup on WCAI. This Sunday marks the 47th annual Falmouth Road Race, which means nearly 13,000 runners will run the 7.3 miles from Woods Hole to Falmouth Heights. But in that 47 years, we've seen temperatures and humidity rise, which could spell trouble for runners. So how will this Cape Cod tradition keep pace with our changing climate? We have WCAI's reporter Eve Zukoff here to tell us more. She went to find out and actually went for a run.
I did. You can hear it in the tape. It's me huffing and puffing. It's pretty brutal. Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So you took a look at the race from a climate change angle, and it required you to kind of go in and dig around into the data dating back to the 1970s. So tell us what you found.
Yeah, so basically this race started in 1972. And so we really wanted to, I went back with a meteorologist to really look at how have humidity and temperature changed since then? Can we actually track that on the Cape? And so we did. And basically what we found is that in the 70s and 80s, there were stretches where it was pretty common that you'd have an overnight low in the upper 50s. And overnight low is a good measure of humidity, actually. That's why we looked at that number. That basically doesn't happen anymore. Now, in fact, since the race has started, the overnight low temperature on average has risen by about 3 degrees Fahrenheit from 61 degrees to 64 degrees Fahrenheit, which is pretty significant in terms of what consequences that can actually bring for people who are running in heat.
Right. And so tell us about like what people are doing about it. Are there consequences for this? I mean, you did say that. So
definitely,
what are they?
Definitely. So, I mean, there's always the risk of heat stroke, dehydration. And I worked with an exercise scientist named Julie Nolan at Sacred Heart University. And she wrote this paper really looking at the health effects of the Falmouth Road Race. And this fascinated me. She found that the Falmouth Road Race produces a much higher rate of exertional heat stroke among runners compared to other races. It's actually 10 times higher compared to other races. And part of that is it's a race run in the middle of August. It's really hot.
Yeah.
And then the other part is, you know, a 26-mile race, a marathon, you can't sustain the level of intensity that you can sustain in a 7-mile race. So people are just pushing. And just to get granular for a second, there are serious consequences to the rising heat and direct correlation with heat stroke. So in 2003, it was 81 degrees Fahrenheit, 87% humidity. That year, 7 out of every 1,000 runners were treated for heat stroke. On years where it's in the 70s in terms of percentage for humidity, you're getting 1 or 2 people.
Oh, wow.
So it's really a powerful correlation.
And it really is a competitive race. So even though people might know that heat stroke is a risk and it can be very serious, you know, they're there to run and they're there to get across that finish line.
Exactly. And it's all tradition, which is kind of the final piece of this, that this is such an iconic Cape tradition. No one wants to see it go, but we also have to be considering health. And so you can kind of file this under the broader heading. What kinds of cultural changes, what kind of cultural losses are we willing to accept to adjust to our changing climate? And for most runners, the answer was like, I'm going to keep running forever. I'm going to keep running until I can't move. But it is something that we should look at for the next 47 years. You know, what do we want to do?
And we'll be taking a look this Sunday for the 47th annual Falmouth Road Race. That is WCAI reporter Eve Zukoff. Thanks so much for coming in and talking about your research.
Thank you.
We are out of time. I want to thank my other guests this hour, Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, and also Sarah Mises-Tan, a reporter here at WCAI. And I want to thank you for listening. Have a great weekend.